It began over a midnight snack. In late 1972, Stanley N. Cohen, a young colleague of Lederberg's at the Stanford School of Medicine, and Herbert W. Boyer, a biochemist at the University of California at San Francisco, were attending a conference in Hawaii. As the scientists talked in a deli late one night, they realized that by teaming up, they might do something that had never been done before: move DNA from one organism into another, creating a new form of life. They wanted to merge the genes of organisms that were wholly unrelated. For example, those of dissimilar germs, or maybe even plants and animals. Scientists had already taken a first step, discovering how enzymes could cut loose individual genes from a strand of DNA. Moving a gene from one organism to another was a greater challenge. Cohen and Boyer saw promise in the early experiments that showed how bugs accomplish such transfers in nature. Genes were found to move on tiny rings of DNA that pass freely between bacteria. Lederberg named these rings plasmids. Researchers had also recently figured out how to glue together snippets of DNA, suggesting an intriguing possibility. Perhaps genes snipped from one organism could hitch a ride on a plasmid as it moved into another. In theory, Cohen and Boyer realized genetic engineering might be simple. The two scientists could slice the DNA from one organism, paste it into a plasmid, and move it into an unrelated form of life. Back in California, the two scientists and their colleagues set to work. In months, they succeeded in creating the first recombinant life. They did not invent the basic technology, but their novel way of applying it quickly created a thriving new field. The serious work began in early 1973. Boyer and Cohen's first experiment centered on Escherichia coli, the normally benign microbe of the human intestinal tract. From an unrelated microbe, they cut out a gene that conferred resistance to penicillin and spliced it into E. coli. Subsequent tests showed it had worked. The new microbe was now immune to the drug. In July 1973, they took a bigger step, splicing genes from the South African clawed toad into E. coli. The new germ successfully reproduced, and its progeny had toad genes. To a limited degree, science had merged bacterium and amphibian. Experimentation showed that not only plasmids, but also viruses could be modified for the purpose of injecting foreign genes, and that targets could include not only microbes, but plant and animal cells. Until the 1973 successes, nobody knew whether genes from one organism would function or even survive in another. Cohen and Boyer showed that they did. Moreover, they demonstrated that crossing the ancient barriers between species, and in time even between plants and animals, was relatively easy. Among the many repercussions was a very practical one. As germs were customized and multiplied, scientists found that their creations could be programmed to make many different kinds of products, such as insulin or other biological compounds. That process is known as gene expression. A germ can divide every half hour. So in a day, one microscopic parent can produce billions of identical offspring. Germs could be turned into vast factories producing a range of products. As the feat was made public, scientists began to worry that the new biology could accidentally release into the environment novel organisms that would wreak havoc. Cohen and Boyer, aware of the danger, had been careful to insert genes that already existed in some populations of natural bacteria or were harmless. But anxiety spread, and scientists called for a temporary global moratorium on such work. At an old chapel overlooking the Pacific, top biologists gathered in February 1975 to hammer out guidelines for research in the nascent field. The youthful leaders were present at the Asilomar Conference Center, as were its elder statesmen, including Lederberg, who was wary of restrictions on peaceful work, fearing they would slow the advance of genetic research. Altogether, there were 90 American and 50 foreign scientists, including some from the Soviet Union. One group of scientists at the meeting warned that the Pentagon might use genetic engineering to make new germs for biological warfare. They called for an international treaty prohibiting gene splicing aimed at making weapons. That suggestion went nowhere. The organizing committee did, however, after considerable debate, win agreement for the most stringent safety precautions. The sticking point was a proposal to prohibit the most dangerous class of experiments, those that involve transplanting genes that are harmful to humans, such as genes that make botulinum toxin. In the end, the motion for a complete ban on such work passed, though five scientists cast dissenting votes. The next month, March 1975, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention went into force, the culmination of 3 years of diplomacy. But the ban was silent on the central issue raised at Asilomar, the military implications of the new biology. The treaty said any kind of research was permitted as long as its purpose was protective. But defensive research could look a lot like offensive work. And the gene splicing pioneered by Cohen and Boyer added an even more troubling complexity, the power to create superbugs. In the months and years that followed, the moratorium on potentially dangerous experiments ended as governments set up review panels to evaluate whether proposed research was safe. Gene engineering took off, first on college campuses, then in industry, as companies began churning out designer germs that produced human insulin, interferon, and growth hormone. The new field, Lederberg wrote in a 1975 article, promises some of the most pervasive benefits for the public health since the discovery and promulgation of antibiotics. Nixon resigned the presidency in August 1974. Soon afterward, Democratic leaders, in a newly combative mood and in firm control of the Senate, began investigating the government's recently abandoned efforts to harness pathogens for war. Lengthy hearings were held in the autumn of 1975, led by Senator Frank Church of Idaho, who was intent on exposing wrongdoing in the shadowy world of American intelligence. The hearings and reports disclosed a new chapter of American history that featured Fort Detrick and the Central Intelligence Agency planning assassinations and stockpiling germs to cripple or kill foreign leaders. The partnership, which extended from 1952 to 1970, had no known successes. The investigation revealed a series of amateurish plots, failed hits, and embarrassing errors. For instance, the Eisenhower administration, fearing a tilt toward Moscow in the newly independent Congo, had planned to kill Patrice Lumumba, who in 1960 was elected prime minister. The plan was rendered moot when rebels seized power and killed Lumumba. Another revelation centered on the Kennedy administration, still eager to undo Castro after the Cuban Missile Crisis. It produced a bizarre scheme to paralyze the dictator, who was a diving enthusiast, by giving him diving gear dusted with two pathogens, including tuberculosis. The plot went awry when an American lawyer gave Castro a wetsuit untreated with the CIA's poison. As congressional investigators dug further, they found that even after Nixon's ban, the CIA had kept a small arsenal of pathogens, germ toxins, and biological poisons that were strong enough to sicken or kill millions of people. The senators blasted the spy agency and army biologists for ignoring the president's order. "We must insist that these agencies operate strictly within the law," Senator Church said. As congressional investigators probed the American germ program, the U.S. intelligence community disagreed on whether the Soviet Union was secretly forging ahead on biological weapons. The disputes began in 1975, the year the Germ Treaty took effect. The time allotted for the destruction of global germ arsenals had been 3 years, the time it took the United States to scrap its own biological weapons. Several government officials wrote a secret paper arguing that the Soviet Union was illegally continuing an offensive program. Their conclusions were dismissed as speculative. At about the same time, a State Department official asserted that the Soviets' new intercontinental missile, the SS-11, was designed to carry a biological warhead. His bosses, one colleague said, found the idea ludicrous. A senior Soviet diplomat stationed at the United Nations defected to the United States in 1978 and warned that his country's military had embarked on a secret biological program, a claim that was viewed as intriguing but unsubstantiated. In October 1979, an odd story appeared in a Russian-language newspaper in Frankfurt, West Germany, that regularly carried news from Soviet émigrés. The paper's sketchy report announced what it called a major germ accident. The death toll was put in the thousands. By January 1980, the newspaper had fresh details. The catastrophe had occurred in April 1979. An explosion at a secret military base near the Soviet city of Sverdlovsk had sent a cloud of deadly microbes wafting over a nearby village. An estimated 1,000 people had eventually died from anthrax. The paper said the Soviet military had seized control of the area, covering the contaminated ground with fresh topsoil. The story gained international prominence in February as the Daily Telegraph in London and the Bild Zeitung in Hamburg ran pieces on what they described as a calamity of agonizing deaths, cremated bodies, and widespread decontamination work. U.S. intelligence analysts had noticed nothing unusual that previous April. Now they began scouring archives of spy satellite photos and intercepted communications from the weeks at issue. Pictures of the area around Compound 19, a military part of Sverdlovsk, seemed suspicious, showing roadblocks, newly paved streets, and what appeared to be decontamination trucks. A report was uncovered that showed that the Soviet defense minister had visited Sverdlovsk just after the incident was said to have taken place. The signs pointed toward a military accident. The reports about Sverdlovsk came at a moment of deepening tensions between the superpowers. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan the previous December had brought an abrupt end to a decade of détente, and President Jimmy Carter was taking a harder line toward Moscow. In March 1980, his administration privately queried Moscow about the Sverdlovsk incident. The next day, before the Soviets could reply, the State Department announced there were disturbing indications that a biological agent had been released. The issue had become a cudgel in the propaganda wars. Moscow denounced the allegations as an epidemic of anti-Soviet hysteria. The outbreak at Sverdlovsk, it said, was caused by nothing more nefarious than tainted meat. A group of intelligence analysts and outside experts convened by the administration dismissed the Soviet explanation. They reviewed the satellite photos and other evidence and closed ranks around this scenario. A mishap at the Sverdlovsk facility had released a plume of deadly anthrax spores into the wind. Some people had died after inhaling the aerosolized microbes, and others had fallen ill weeks later after eating the meat of infected cattle. The group felt that it needed two etiologies because the epidemic had gone on for 7 weeks. The disease, it concluded, came first by inhalation, then by consumption of stores of infected meat. Around this time, intelligence analysts began piecing together what they viewed as an even more disturbing story of human suffering in a distant part of the world. Hmong refugees from Laos were reporting that helicopters flown by Soviet-backed government forces had sprayed them with a mysterious substance that left horrific burns and lesions on their skin. The refugees called it yellow rain. To investigate, the Army sent a medical team which interviewed 38 Hmong tribesmen in October 1979. The symptoms and accounts, the officers reported, seemed to suggest attacks by as many as 3 different toxic agents, including one that caused internal bleeding. Ronald Reagan took office in January 1981, determined to confront what he would eventually call the evil empire. Weeks later, the administration was handed a yellow rain contaminated plant sample collected by the Thai military near the Cambodian border. A private American laboratory analyzed the material for Washington and reported that the leaf and stem were contaminated with unnaturally high levels of mycotoxins, harshly toxic substances that occur in low concentrations in some crops or can be extracted from fungi. Administration analysts believed the sample advanced the argument that the Soviets were using biological weapons, which was already being built around blood samples and eyewitness testimony. Still, some of the biological and chemical weapons specialists, known colloquially inside the government as bugs and gas experts, urged caution. The results were unconfirmed, and other samples and blood awaited analysis. The Thai sample was important, but short of a smoking gun, they warned. Reagan's new Secretary of State, Alexander M. Haig, Jr., pressed ahead. On September 13, 1981, he announced at a conference in West Berlin that the United States had physical evidence that Moscow's surrogates in Southeast Asia were using deadly toxins to wage biological warfare. If true, the charges were stunning, suggesting a blatant violation of the Germ Treaty that went well beyond what might have happened accidentally at Sverdlovsk. Haig's allegations touched off a contentious debate that would echo through the rest of the decade, dividing scientists, government officials, and even America's allies. The arguments over the Soviet germ program were rooted in a clash of cultures between the biologists and the intelligence analysts. Scientists are trained to work solely from empirical evidence, preferably drawn from experiments they can observe and document firsthand. Almost everything else is suspect. We're in the business of being skeptical, Meselson said of scientists. If you've got to have an answer and you're willing to have a 40% chance of being wrong, ask somebody else. Intelligence analysis is as much an art as a science. The evidence, the reports from spies, the snippets of overheard conversations, the photos from satellites hundreds of miles overhead, is inevitably incomplete, sometimes contradictory, and always open to varying interpretations. The conclusions of intelligence analysts are comparable to grand jury indictments, offering charges, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. They spark debates more often than they settle them. The disputes can rage for years, settled only when intelligence officers recruit a spy or defector who delivers the inside story. The need for human intelligence, HUMINT as it is known, is particularly acute in the study of biological weapons programs, which can be easily hidden within legitimate research establishments. From the outside, research on defenses against germs does not look much different from the development of germ weapons. As scientists and intelligence analysts hashed out the evidence, the Reagan administration battered the Soviets publicly and privately over germ weapons for much of the 1980s. It was perfect stuff for a propaganda war. In 1985, General Maxwell R. Thurman, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, conducted what the military called a functional area assessment of germ defense. He gathered several dozen top generals and civilians in a room to critique training, doctrine, and equipment. Thurman's report found deficiencies in all three. The military was seriously underprepared. American forces would be, in essence, naked if attacked by a conventional agent like anthrax. A wiry, intense man with a buzz cut and a short temper, Thurman was known affectionately as Mad Max. He was popular, a soldier's soldier. Bill Richardson, a Pentagon civilian with decades of experience in chemical and biological defense, admired Thurman's drive, but felt that his confrontational tactics were doomed to fail. Thurman pushed extremely, too extremely, Richardson recalled. The system grinds on regardless, and vice chiefs come and go. Thurman's report was largely ignored. As the documents circulated, the Army's medical officers asked pharmaceutical manufacturers to submit bids on what it would cost to build the stockpile recommended by Richard Spurzel, a top germ specialist at Fort Detrick, and David Huxall, the head of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Disease. One company offered to open a new factory that would produce millions of doses of vaccine against anthrax, botulinum, and other agents. The price was high, several $100 million, and Army medical officials could not persuade the Pentagon to make the investment. One of the key deficiencies of military preparedness identified by Thurman was a lack of vaccines against what Bill Patrick called the oldie moldies, the traditional agents such as anthrax and botulinum. In the late 1980s, a young Army major named Robert Eng decided to do something about the problem. Eng was serving in the office of the Army Surgeon General as the medical defense officer for NBC, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Weapons. Soon after he took the job, he learned that the military had little vaccine stockpiled to protect soldiers against anthrax or botulinum, the two best-known biological agents. Eng set out to arrange the purchase of 500,000 doses of vaccine, enough to give 160,000 soldiers the first three shots of the six-shot series. He turned for help to Anna Johnson Weiniger, a civilian Army official with a doctorate in microbiology. Johnson Weiniger understood the destructive power of the anthrax bacillus firsthand. She had specialized in the pathogen while working at Fort Detrick as a researcher before moving to the Army command that handled medical programs. Johnson Weiniger was one of the few people in the United States government to have received the anthrax inoculation, which was developed in the 1950s and licensed by the Food and Drug Administration in 1970. The vaccine was administered in six shots spaced out over 18 months. Doctors had little experience with it. In nearly two decades, the vaccine had been given only to a small number of technicians and researchers at Fort Detrick and several hundred workers at wool factories. Some of those receiving the shots complained of swelling and other localized reactions after receiving the injections. There were no reports of long-lasting harm. By this time, America's major pharmaceutical manufacturers were fleeing the vaccine business, driven out by low profits and a rising number of lawsuits. Universal vaccinations for children had vanquished diseases such as whooping cough. But after taking the shots, a handful of patients had suffered severe reactions, including brain damage and death. The scientific evidence tying these cases to immunizations was in dispute, but juries were sympathetic to the young victims and had delivered some staggering judgments against drug manufacturers. By the mid-1980s, shortages of vaccine were emerging. There was a single licensed manufacturer of anthrax vaccine in the United States, an antiquated laboratory operated by the Michigan Department of Public Health in Lansing. Established in 1925, the lab had developed the first diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine. Some of its buildings dated to the Depression. Others had been built in by the Army during World War II. Officials at the Michigan lab told Johnson Weiniger that they could not possibly meet Eng's goal. The facility had been making small batches of the anthrax vaccine about once every 4 years, yielding between 15,000 and 17,000 doses. On September 29, 1988, the Army signed its first ever contract to buy large quantities of anthrax vaccine, asking Michigan to produce and store 300,000 doses. Under the contract, the Army agreed to pay for bigger fermenters in which germs are grown for vaccine making. Much of the lab's equipment was more than 20 years old, and as one Army document put it, certainly not state-of-the-art. Recognizing the difficulties of speeding up production, the Army gave Michigan 5 years, until September 1993, to deliver the 300,000 doses. The number of analysts working on bugs and gas had grown rapidly during the Reagan years, and the intelligence agencies began to collect new information about germ weapons and to issue reports on their spread to third world countries. In June 1988, the analysts reported that Iraq was well on its way to building a bacteriological arsenal under the cover of legitimate scientific research. According to their report, Baghdad scientists had already produced weapons from Clostridium botulinum, which produces a deadly toxin 10,000 times more lethal than nerve gas. It said Iraq was also trying to produce research and development quantities of weapons from anthrax and other deadly microbes. Intelligence reports are often larded with caveats, but this one included several alarming claims. It said Iraqi scientists were developing germs for assassinations, and it reported that Hussein Kamel, President Saddam Hussein's son-in-law and the head of Baghdad's powerful intelligence agency, was personally supervising the biological research. These details, which suggested that the program was supported by the most important elements of the Iraqi dictatorship, were accompanied by a revelation that should have caught the eye of senior American officials. Iraqi scientists were buying their starter germs, the foundation of any biological weapons program, from an American company. According to the report, the Iraqis are very good organizers and excel at purchasing needed offensive supplies using procedures which effectively disguise their intent. They are currently purchasing bacterial strains from the American Type Culture Collection. A scientific supply company then located in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, the American Type Culture Collection was a natural focal point for Iraq's clandestine effort. It housed the world's largest collection of germ strains, including particularly virulent variants of anthrax and botulinum discovered in the mid-1950s as part of the American Germ Warfare Program. The collection served as a global lending library for scientists beginning their own research in the field of microbiology and was considered an important tool in the fight to improve global health. Overseas customers were required to obtain a license from the Commerce Department to export the most virulent strains, but in the 1980s, this was largely a formality. Applications from Iraq or anywhere else were seldom denied. In May 1986, the company had sold an assortment of germs to the University of Baghdad, including 3 different types of anthrax, 5 variants of botulinum, and 3 kinds of brucella, which causes an animal disease, brucellosis, that is incapacitating but rarely fatal. Further orders were planned. There seemed little reason to stop them. In the late 1980s, American officials viewed Iraq as more of an ally than a possible foe. For most of the decade, American policy had been to tilt toward Baghdad in its long war with Iran, and the United States even provided the Iraqi army with spy satellite photographs of Iranian troop formations. The American military's contingency plan for the Persian Gulf presumed that American forces would be called upon to defend the region's oil fields against a Soviet thrust into Iran, and that they would join forces with Iraq to fight the Soviet army. American officials had been disturbed by Iraq's use of nerve gas against its Kurdish minority. Nevertheless, the relationship continued. The intelligence report on Iraq's biological efforts went to the State Department, the CIA, and various parts of the military, including the Central Command, which planned and directed American operations in the Middle East. It prompted no action. No one called the American Type Culture Collection to warn against further sales of germs to Baghdad. No one suggested that the Commerce Department withhold licenses on germ exports bound for Iraq. On September 29, 1988, 3 months after the report was completed, 11 strains of germs, including 4 types of anthrax, were sent from Maryland to Iraq. The order was placed by the Iraqi Ministry of Trade's Technical and Scientific Materials Import Division, or TSMID, which American intelligence officials had already identified as a front for Baghdad's purchases of germ weapons materials. One of the microbes, strain 11966, was a type of anthrax developed by Fort Detrick in 1951 for germ warfare. Belatedly, the intelligence on Iraq prompted American officials to prohibit the transfer of more germs to Baghdad. On February 23, 1989, the Commerce Department banned sales of anthrax and dozens of other pathogens to not only Iraq, but Iran, Libya, and Syria, which were also suspected of trying to develop germ weapons. The ban, said the announcement, grew out of heightened concern about the biological threat. Despite this heightened concern, during the last years of the Reagan administration and the early years of George Bush's presidency, Washington had limited enthusiasm for countering any kind of germ threat. The Cold War was ending, the propaganda war against Moscow winding down. Independent experts increasingly questioned whether anyone was really building deadly biological arms. The treaty was working, they said. The doubts reached into the ranks of the nation's military officers, most of whom had never liked germ weapons in the first place. Many approved of the ban. By the late 1980s, germ warfare was on the fringes of American military strategy, and the gene revolution just made things worse with its vision of more terrifying agents that could outwit vaccines. When American national security officials weighed the military balance with the Soviets, they worried about conventional weapons, nuclear missiles, and Moscow's huge arsenal of chemical munitions. The problems resulting from a biological attack were too staggering to contemplate. What could a NATO force defending Europe really do if it were doused by anthrax or some other germ? The airplanes, airfields, and gear would all be contaminated. The soldiers would all be dead or gasping for breath. Nothing in the warrior culture of the American military accustomed planners to thinking about battle as a medical competition. General Brent Scowcroft, a retired Air Force officer who had served as National Security Advisor to Presidents Ford and Bush, summed up the prevailing attitude in an interview years later. "I have a bias," he said. "To me, biological weapons are not practical or militarily useful. As terror weapons, they're fine, but in the context of warfare, they're too imprecise, the reaction's too delayed. They're not likely to be employed." The United States military had no real plans for how it might defend itself against a germ threat. "There's an inbox, an outbox, and a too-hard-to-do box," recalled one officer. "We saw it as a threat, but we didn't want to deal with it, to put together a war plan. It was too difficult." The United States also had no plans to protect the civilian population from biological attack. A few specialists, including Bill Patrick and Josh Lederberg, had begun warning that terrorists might try germ weapons. But the Oregon salad bar attack was forgotten, and most senior government officials who thought about the problem at all saw germ weapons as an issue for the military. Why would any group want to unleash an epidemic when explosives could make a similar point without endangering the attackers? To the public, the case that Moscow was making biological weapons seemed cloudier than ever. Meselson and such allies as Thomas D. Seeley of Yale University had undermined the government's claims on yellow rain, making their arguments in a series of carefully documented articles over several years. Questions also remained about Sverdlovsk. The Soviets had repeatedly rebuffed the requests from Meselson and others to allow an independent team to visit the city and investigate the outbreak. But Moscow eventually said it had new studies showing that the deaths were caused by tainted meat. In April 1988, Meselson arranged for two Soviet scientists to come to the United States to make their case at public meetings in Cambridge, Baltimore, and Washington. The meetings were polite, with no pointed challenges to the bad meat claim. Meselson said he found the Soviet account completely plausible and consistent with what we know from the literature and other recorded experiences with animal and human anthrax. He thought more investigation was needed inside the Soviet Union, but, as he told a Senate hearing in May 1989, "today, to the best of my knowledge, no nation possesses a stockpile of biological or toxin weapons." A few months later, in October 1989, a top Soviet biologist defected to Britain and told a very different story. Vladimir Pasechnik described to interrogators a top-secret world in which tens of thousands of specialists were laboring to perfect and deploy germ weapons. "Yes," Pasechnik said, "the Soviet Union had produced long-range missiles to deliver germs." He had been the director of the Institute for Ultra-Pure Biological Preparations in Leningrad, one of scores of false fronts scattered throughout the Soviet Union. His institute of 400 scientists, he said, had been doing research on modifying cruise missiles to spread germs. The low-flying robotic craft, which can outwit early warning systems, were adapted to spray clouds of aerosolized pathogens over unsuspecting foes. Pasechnik told his British handlers that his institute had put the discoveries of Cohen and Boyer to lethal use. Plasmids, the tiny rings of DNA crucial for gene engineering, also control a germ's natural defenses against microbial foes. The Soviets had tinkered with the plasmids of plague, making the new strain impervious to existing vaccines and antibiotics. It was a disconcerting milestone. Pasechnik's disclosures gave Moscow's work on classical agents and engineered pathogens new importance. Super plague, Pasechnik explained, was no mere laboratory curiosity. The Soviets had packed a dry, powdered form of the germ into bombs, rocket warheads, and artillery shells, and it was only one of many improved agents that the Soviet Union had developed. American intelligence officials began to look closely at foreign germ efforts, especially those involving the new biology. In June 1990, analysts zeroed in on Iraq's research center at Al-Tuwaitha near Baghdad. The facility employed some of Iraq's best military scientists and in 1981 had been preemptively bombed by Israel, which suspected it was making fuel for nuclear weapons. Now American experts at the Defense Intelligence Agency studied its buying patterns for advanced supplies and grew to suspect that Al-Tuwaitha was doing molecular biology and genetic engineering for new classes of biological weapons, the same thing Pasechnik had warned that the Soviets were doing. This was plausible, the analysts wrote in a report, because the center had produced no publications in these areas. There were, of course, innocent explanations for the purchases, but Al-Tuwaitha's history and its high security precautions worried the analysts. Was Iraq, like the Soviet Union, trying to develop a lethal edge? Saddam. In September 1990, a researcher breathing through a respirator and clad in protective gear, head-to-toe suit, two pairs of gloves, and two pairs of boots, walked into a laboratory at Fort Detrick and injected a rhesus monkey with enough anesthetic to render it unconscious. As the monkey's breathing slowed, she moved the monkey to a plexiglass box, placed its head in a rubber-lined enclosure, and turned on an aerosol device, which released a carefully measured dose of Bacillus anthracis, the microbe that causes anthrax. The germs were Volume 1B, the same strain sold to Iraq. One by one, 60 monkeys were infected and returned to their cages. The experiment, one of the most ambitious ever attempted at Fort Detrick, had an unusual practical urgency. Saddam Hussein's army had invaded Kuwait on August 2, 1990, and American intelligence agencies believed that his arsenal included germ weapons. The experiment was designed to find out which treatments offered the best protection after an anthrax attack, antibiotics alone, vaccines, or a combination. Years of neglect had left American forces vulnerable. None of the soldiers or reservists serving in the military had been inoculated against anthrax or other well-known biological threats, despite accumulating evidence of wide Soviet preparations for germ warfare. The Pentagon had no plans for how it might surge production of vaccine in a crisis and had little of it on hand. Even more significant, the armed forces lacked equipment to detect attacks with germ weapons such as anthrax, which takes hold in the body over several days. By the time a patient infected with Bacillus anthracis becomes feverish, the first sign of the illness, it is often too late. The scramble at Fort Detrick to study possible treatments of the disease was only one sign of how much was lacking. After a month, the results of the experiment were in, and they deepened the dilemma facing General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, the field commander of the Allied Army assembling in Saudi Arabia. 30 days of antibiotics had prevented anthrax in most of the monkeys, but the anthrax spores, which can hide for weeks in the lymph system, proved resilient and there were some differences among the antibiotics. 3 of the 10 monkeys who received penicillin died after the treatment was halted. Those given doxycycline, or ciprofloxacin, fared better, with only 1 monkey in each group dying of anthrax after the treatment stopped. The combination of vaccine and doxycycline performed best, with all monkeys surviving through the months after the experiment ended. The study included a significant proviso. Every monkey had begun treatment within 24 hours of exposure. The message seemed clear. A month of antibiotics improved a patient's odds, but were not a complete solution. Even the newest and most effective of them, doxycycline or ciprofloxacin, eventually failed in about 10% of cases. That would potentially mean tens of thousands of casualties if a large group of soldiers was attacked. The best defense against germ attack, the experiment suggested, was inoculating the troops before they set foot in the Persian Gulf region. If that wasn't possible, and it almost certainly was not given the shortage of vaccine, Allied forces could feel confident in the face of the anthrax threat only if they could administer antibiotics and vaccine within a day of attack. They needed 3 items: detectors that could warn immediately of exposure, large reserves of vaccine, and enough antibiotics to treat every soldier for at least a month. Antibiotics could be found on the global market, but the technology to detect airborne anthrax spores was in its infancy and would almost certainly not be available before the January 15, 1991 deadline set by the United Nations for Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. Prospects for boosting supplies of vaccine by that date were equally clouded. The facilities at the Michigan Department of Public Health could not come close to bridging the gap. American industry had met such challenges before, but speeding up production of a drug was not like ordering a defense contractor to punch out more tanks or mortars. A new vaccine factory would need FDA approval and would have to comply with strict rules for making drugs, a process that takes years. Schwarzkopf had begun to worry about the Iraqi threat months earlier, soon after he took over the Central Command, or CENTCOM, which was responsible for defending the Persian Gulf. As he moved the command's headquarters to Saudi Arabia, he included in his list of pressing issues the following statement: "In all directives and orders, include that we must be prepared to fight in a chemical environment." Aides took Schwarzkopf's order as shorthand. Chemical, in military parlance, means chem-bio, chemical and biological weapons. Intelligence analysis of Iraq's biological capabilities began to circulate more widely at the Pentagon. The analysts delivered a simple message. American troops could be badly hurt by germ weapons. Top officials at the White House and the Pentagon, struggling to assemble an international coalition against Baghdad, were scarcely aware of the issue. But in the less traveled corridors of the Pentagon, the men and women assigned to supply the troops and protect their health understood immediately. In early August 1990, Army health officials spelled out the dimensions of the problem to General Schwarzkopf's aides. The Army had only 10,000 doses of the anthrax vaccine on the shelf. Even if the supplies were stretched by giving each soldier only 2 or 3 shots, the Army had enough to protect at best a few thousand soldiers. Army officials rushed to Michigan to assess whether the Department of Health could step up production. The laboratory had been pushing to fill the Pentagon's 1988 order for anthrax vaccine even before Iraq invaded Kuwait. It had 140,000 doses that could be ready to ship by late September, enough to protect about 46,000 soldiers. The pace was ahead of schedule, but it was nowhere near enough to immunize the hundreds of thousands of soldiers who would be assembling in Saudi Arabia. The military's choices for protecting its troops against an attack with botulinum were even more limited. Botulism is extremely rare, and American drug companies, lacking a market, had never paid the considerable costs of putting the vaccine through full clinical trials. Tests suggested that it was safe for humans, but the larger-scale studies, which researchers rely upon to uncover less common side effects, had never been done, even though the vaccine had been around for more than 2 decades. The drug was experimental. Under federal rules, it could not be given to patients unless they gave informed consent, after learning of all the possible risks. Stocks of the vaccine totaled just 34,000 doses, enough for no more than 10,000 soldiers. On August 20th, Pentagon health officials pulled together a committee of experts. Its members amounted to the government's brain trust on biological weapons, an assortment of doctors, intelligence specialists, and mid-level military officers who understood the issue. Their title was appropriately wonkish: the Ad Hoc Working Group for the Medical Defense Against Biological Warfare. The site of their meeting was revealing. Proximity to power is a status symbol in military culture, with top defense officials competing for the coveted offices in the Pentagon on the E-ring near the Secretary of Defense. The Ad Hoc Committee gathered at the Army Surgeon General's office in a building on traffic-clogged Leesburg Pike, miles from the Pentagon. The meeting quickly got down to business, and by 4 p.m., when they adjourned, the officials had agreed on a far-reaching recommendation. The United States should immediately begin vaccinating troops sent to Saudi Arabia, using available supplies to protect those most at risk. The top medical officers of the Army and the Air Force endorsed the plan, as did Enrique Mendez, the Pentagon's senior civilian official on health issues. The Armed Forces Epidemiology Board urged anthrax vaccination as soon as possible, reflecting the medical consensus. Mendez drafted a memo for Dick Cheney, the defense secretary, ordering the inoculations to begin. Cheney and General Colin L. Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Schwarzkopf all believed that the recommendation needed more study. The plans envisioned keeping any vaccination program secret, but Saudi Arabia was crawling with reporters, and the inoculation of large numbers of troops was certain to leak out. The vaccinations would also complicate the administration's most important diplomatic initiative, assembling an international coalition against Saddam Hussein. The United States did not have nearly enough vaccine to protect its own soldiers, let alone those of its allies, the American civilians living in the country, or Saudi civilians. On September 21, 1990, Powell met with the commanders of the nation's armed services in the tank, the sealed, spy-proof conference room in the Pentagon reserved for the regular meetings of the heads of the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. The Joint Chiefs decided it would do more harm than good to begin vaccinations immediately. Contradicting the intelligence analysts, they concluded that the threat was tenuous. There was no confirmation that Iraq had figured out how to turn the germs it was producing into weapons. A memo written after the meeting succinctly summarized the outcome. The decisions were no longer medical in origin. Rather, they were political, social, and military operational. This did not mean that Powell was taking the threat of biological warfare lightly. A career infantryman, Powell was far more worried about Iraq's germ arsenal than its chemical weapons. American soldiers, he felt, were prepared to defeat a chemical attack. They had trained for it, had practiced combat operations in suits and masks. "You can deal with CW," Powell said in an interview years later. "Chemicals don't linger. You can get out of their way. I knew how to handle it." The Allied germ defenses, by contrast, were improvised, drawn up on the fly. "BW was a wild card," he recalled, "something I had less ability to deal with." The situation did not surprise Powell. "I'd been kicking around 30-odd years," he said. "I was quite aware that we did not have protective equipment or vaccines." Powell picked Brigadier General John Jumper, a one-star general working for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to serve as his personal emissary on the issue to push the production of vaccine and detectors. Jumper told Powell, "Sir, I think you've got the wrong guy. I'm just a dumb fighter pilot from Paris, Texas. I've got a degree from VMI in electrical engineering. I don't know much about this." "Don't worry," said Powell. "You just have to know how to fix things." Jumper set out to educate himself. He quickly learned that the Michigan Department of Public Health was the nation's only licensed producer of vaccine against both botulinum and anthrax. An antidote to botulinum, known as antitoxin, could be extracted from the blood of horses or other animals exposed to the disease. But the United States had only one horse, named First Flight, that could produce the medicine, an experimental drug that had been given to only a handful of people. Jumper found a picture of the horse and mounted it on an easel for one of his briefings of the military chiefs. "This," he declared, "is the entire industrial base for production of botulinum antitoxin in the United States." The generals reacted with disbelief. Jumper received briefings from expert after expert. What surprised him most was the military's lack of a doctrine for biological defense. There had been no planning for how to handle casualties, where to put detectors, or who would be inoculated. It wasn't even clear that there would be any detectors. For decades, the Army had been trying to design equipment that could sniff an aerosolized cloud of germs and provide immediate warning of a germ attack to soldiers. Scientists had not come close to conquering the technical challenges. The air is filled with biological material, from pollen to germs. No one could figure out how to design a machine that could distinguish between the normal background and germ weapons. A 1970s Army system, a gigantic air-sniffing device coupled with a crude detector, had been shelved because of its limited accuracy. Shortly after the Iraqi invasion, Powell ordered the Defense Nuclear Agency to improvise a detector that could be mounted on an airplane. The initial tests were encouraging, but the plans were shelved when the prototype airplane was destroyed in a crash. The vaccine shortage worried the Pentagon's top civilian health officials. Peter Collis, an emergency room physician who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, pressed the ad hoc working group to find other sources of vaccine production. He decided the group needed a more inspiring name. Collis, who had studied infectious diseases as an Army doctor, remembered from medical school that anthrax spores were unusually persistent and that the illness could be contracted from household items, even a shaving brush. The best shaving brushes were made from the hair of badgers. The ad hoc working group for the medical defense against biological warfare became Project Badger. "You can't do that," an aide said, reminding him of the Pentagon's procedures for code names. "I just did," said Collis. The team included Anna Johnson Weiniger, the civilian official who had tried to build the stockpile of anthrax vaccine through the late 1980s. She was a natural choice for Project Badger. Pentagon officials were baffled by why the pace of production could not be accelerated. She tried to explain. The conversations were frustrating to both sides. "Just call them up and tell them to deliver 500,000 doses next week." "Sorry, can't do that." "Well, money's no object. It's not a matter of money. They can make three times as much as they used to by putting on three shifts of workers a day. What do you want them to do, stand there and watch the bacteria grow?" Johnson Weiniger explained the basics to her uniformed colleagues. The only way to speed up production was with multiple assembly lines, which would have to be certified by the FDA. The vaccines had to be processed, tested for potency and sterility, and packaged. The schedule could not be truncated. Every major pharmaceutical company in the United States was approached for help. The responses were discouraging. Producing anthrax vaccine posed special problems. Its spores were so dangerous and so long-lasting that buildings and fermenters in which the vaccine was made could never be used for anything else. Making botulinum vaccine was an even greater production challenge. The microbes had to be grown in an oxygen-free environment. There were seven different strains, each requiring its own fermenter and production line. Botulinum antitoxin, refined from the blood of horses or other animals, posed its own problems. It took months of repeated exposure to the biological poison to stimulate the immune systems of the animals. Project Badger set out to supplement the production of the Army's lone horse, First Flight, by placing orders for 100 horses that were to be kept in paddocks at Fort Detrick. The experts knew it would be as much as a year before the first lots of antitoxin could be refined and purified from the Army's herd. Of the 150 companies Johnson Weiniger approached to make anthrax vaccine, only 15 owned the appropriate equipment, and only Letterly agreed to try producing it. Collis tried calling the CEOs of pharmaceutical companies himself telling them the Secretary of Defense had personally authorized him to make the request. The results were no better. Part of the problem was the deal Collis and the Project Badger team was offering. The Army had decided not to indemnify the companies against lawsuits, even though vaccine makers faced huge potential liabilities from people who suffer severe reactions to the drug. At a meeting in early October, the Project Badger team promised the Army that it would have significantly more vaccine available by April 1, 1991. Colonel Harry Dangerfield, a senior member of the committee, viewed the commitment as optimistic. Any vaccine for American troops would be inspected by the FDA, which often rejected entire lots. Producing mass quantities of anthrax or botulinum vaccine would take close to a year, not a few months. We were faced with a problem that couldn't be solved in the time frame it needed to be solved, he said later. The people setting the goals just didn't understand what the issue was. Within weeks of the invasion of Kuwait, intelligence reports about Iraq's biological program were circulating among more senior officials in the Pentagon. One of those officials who felt particularly frustrated by the report's carefully hedged language was I. Lewis Libby, a trim, boyish lawyer and one of the Pentagon's top policy officials. His job as deputy to Paul Wolfowitz, the Undersecretary for Policy, was to think two or three steps ahead on the international chessboard. Where was the next hot spot? What could be done to head off trouble? What were policymakers overlooking as they coped with the rush of day-to-day crises? To Libby, the words probably and possibly jumped out of the reports about Iraq's biological program. He thought the analysis was cogent as far as it went, but it left open the most important questions about Iraq's intentions. Libby knew the United States had few spies inside Saddam Hussein's secretive regime who could provide so-called real-time intelligence. The reports on biological weapons drew largely on satellite photographs of suspect sites, snatches of intercepted telephone conversations, and interviews with Western businessmen who had sold equipment to Iraq. Libby told colleagues that intelligence analysts had an unfortunate habit. If they did not see a report on something, they assumed it did not exist. Or, as another veteran intelligence officer put it, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. A few weeks after American troops began gathering in the deserts of Saudi Arabia, Libby assembled his top aides to coordinate defense against biological warfare. His instructions were simple. If we go to war and Saddam uses biological weapons, I want to be able to look in the eyes of the soldiers and their families and say, we did everything we could. He asked an aide, a career Navy officer named Captain Larry Sequist, to look more closely at whether Saddam really had a usable germ arsenal. Sequist, who had commanded the battleship Iowa, proved an inspired choice. Navy captains are trained to be generalists who can master the interlocking complexities of complicated engineering systems. Sequist's skills as a quick study served him well. He was not afraid to dive into the unknown. Learning about biological weapons was no different from what he had done all his life in the Navy. In his view, you just had to start asking the right questions and keep at it. In late September 1990, Sequist and another officer who reported to Libby, Colonel George Rock, flew to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio for their education in biological warfare. By the end of the day, Sequist and Rock were reeling. Biological warfare could be just as deadly as a nuclear attack, if not more so. The implications for the conflict in the Gulf were immediately clear. Saddam Hussein had the means to inflict catastrophic, Hiroshima-sized harm on the Allied forces with a single, well-planned attack. The two military officers drove their rental car back to the airport, struggling to digest what they had learned. Their conversation continued in the departure lounge, where they became so absorbed that they missed their return flight. Sequist asked intelligence officials in Washington more detailed questions. The scientists at Wright-Patterson had said biological weapons could be easily disseminated from aerosol sprayers used to apply pesticides. Did Iraq have an ample supply? Yes, they replied. In the spring of 1990, the Iraqis bought 40 top-of-the-line aerosol generators from an Italian company. Each one was capable of dispersing 800 gallons per hour. They were compact enough to fit on the back of a pickup truck, small boat, or single-engine aircraft, and could disperse either liquid or dry biological agents. Sequist looked over the weather charts for the Saudi desert. On 3 to 5 nights a week in the fall, he noticed, there was a temperature inversion, meaning that a layer of hot air sat atop the cool air near the ground. Sequist understood the significance. Inversions make biological weapons much more deadly because they trap a cloud of agent over the target. He did some more calculations. Assume the United States had 200,000 troops camped out in Saudi Arabia. If the Iraqis could slip a single small boat equipped with an aerosol generator into the Persian Gulf, it could unleash a cloud of anthrax that would, in appropriate weather conditions, kill 90% of the soldiers. Sequist had made a crucial leap, one that would elude some of his more senior colleagues. The distinctions in the intelligence reports between producing large quantities of an agent and turning it into a weapon were not as important as they appeared. In germ warfare, the germ was the weapon. Saddam's engineers did not need to invent a workable biological missile or shell. The aerosol generators they bought in the spring of 1990 would do just fine. And then there was the terrorist threat. Sequist and Libby hauled in the intelligence officials for additional briefings. What if Saddam Hussein announced just prior to war with the United States that he had 5 containers that would release biological weapons in Washington? Could he do that? You bet, came the answer. Sequist spelled out his conclusions in a highly classified memo for Libby and Paul Wolfowitz. The United States was vulnerable both at home and on the battlefield. Josh Lederberg, too, was worrying about the potential threat to civilians. Saddam Hussein's statement earlier in the year that he would burn Israel with his fire was widely taken as a threat to use chemical and biological weapons. As a member of the Defense Science Board, Lederberg had access to some of the classified intelligence on the Iraqi biological program. I knocked on every door, got to see Brent Scowcroft, got to see the intelligence people, the FBI, he said. He also asked a simple question. What are we going to do about the civilian population? No one had thought through which government agencies would respond to a domestic germ attack. Lederberg urged Scowcroft, Bush's national security advisor, to begin planning civil defenses. Saddam Hussein's most likely use of germ weapons, he argued, would be through a surrogate, a terrorist group. White House officials quietly began assembling an emergency response team centered at the Department of Health and Human Services. The staffer who handled his meeting with Scowcroft was a rising young star named Condoleezza Rice, a Soviet specialist whom Lederberg had known when she was a student at Stanford. The preparations were modest, a training exercise or two and some antibiotics stockpiled in the Washington area. But Lederberg felt he had made a contribution. The nation's capital had been made somewhat less vulnerable to terrorist attack. America's top military commanders were beginning to understand the magnitude of the threat. In Riyadh, General Schwarzkopf felt trapped. He was persuaded that the biological threat was real, but the supplies of vaccine were well short of what was needed. Someone was going to have to play God by deciding who would be protected. Schwarzkopf believed such a decision should be made in Washington and kept pressing the Joint Chiefs to deliver enough vaccine to immunize everyone. It was a nightmare, he said years later. Schwarzkopf was also frustrated by the carefully worded assessments coming from the intelligence agencies. He needed facts, not surmises. What was Iraq's doctrine for using germ weapons? Did their missiles have germ warheads? The bugs and gas experts in Washington were chagrined by their own inability to provide clearer answers. But there was just not enough first-hand information available on a program that was one of Iraq's most closely guarded secrets. An October 22nd report by the Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center was typical. Large quantities of anthrax bacteria and botulinum toxin likely have been produced, it said. We believe that these agents have been weaponized and that biological and toxin munitions already exist. The analyst mentioned another potentially disturbing bit of news. The Baghdad offices of a Chilean company that was supplying cluster bombs to Iraq had been overheard discussing the parameters for aerosol testing of botulinum toxin with the Home Office. Did this mean that Iraq had such a weapon? The analysts were not sure. The evidence, they wrote, would allow only the inferential assessment that the Iraqis were trying to buy such weapons, not that they had them. On the crucial question of what Iraq might do with its weapons in a war, its use doctrine, the experts admitted what Schwarzkopf already knew. There were significant intelligence gaps. Defense Intelligence Agency officials acknowledged there is no reliable information on how Iraq might use their BW weapons. The most suitable way is in a clandestine manner prior to the outset of hostilities. The impasse over when to begin inoculations continued, and Powell returned to the tank to confer with the chiefs of the four branches of the American military. Only the Navy supported immediate vaccination. A few days later, on October 21st, Charles Freeman, the American ambassador in Riyadh, raised his own objections. Vaccinating soldiers but not civilians was a bad idea, Freeman warned in a secret cable. It could sow panic, fracture the coalition. Besides, there were American citizens in the region working on oil projects. What about them? There would be a public relations disaster, Freeman warned, if the United States protected only its soldiers. Intelligence officials began trying to figure out what might prompt the Iraqi leader to use his germ weapons. If Saddam concluded his personal position was becoming hopeless, CIA analysts warned in November 1990, this could convince him to use biological weapons to shock the coalition into a ceasefire. In such a situation, the use of anthrax against a coalition military installation or major Saudi oil facility might seem an attractive option. Air Force officers drawing up Allied plans for a massive bombing of Iraq thought they could resolve some of the uncertainties about Baghdad's germ program with a few well-placed explosives. American intelligence had identified what it believed were Iraq's main research and production sites for biological weapons, as well as more than a dozen refrigerated bunkers. The analysts were not sure what Iraq was doing with the bunkers. Air Force officers designing the air campaign planned to demolish them and any other structures that might be linked to the Iraqi biological program. That stirred a new set of uncertainties among intelligence analysts back in Washington. No one was sure what would happen if you bombed a building or bunker packed with anthrax or botulinum. Would a plume of agents scatter illness and death across the region? Some preliminary calculations by yet another hastily assembled committee of experts, dubbed the Interagency Fusion Group, suggested that casualties inside Iraq could be staggering. Attacks on 10 separate sites in Iraq, they estimated, could kill more than 150,000 Iraqi civilians, more than the number of people killed by the Hiroshima bomb. The British weighed in with an equally gloomy assessment. General Charles Horner, the Riyadh-based American commander who was planning the air assault on Iraq, believed that the estimates were exaggerated. His aides proposed several ways of minimizing the risk. The bunkers could be hit with bombs that would cause them to implode rather than explode. Pilots could drop incendiary devices, creating a blast of heat that would kill the spores. The missions could be flown just before dawn so that if a plume of anthrax were inadvertently released, it would be weakened by the day's heat and light. In December 1990, Horner briefed Cheney and Powell on his plans for bombing the bunkers. He described the revised calculations of how much anthrax might waft across Iraq after a raid. "I can't promise you we are not going to have casualties in this," he told them. "There has got to be a penalty for a country that manufactures and stores these horrible weapons. So if there is a fallout, and if there are civilian casualties from this, maybe that point needs to be made to all the other countries who conceive to do this." A few weeks later, the fusion group acknowledged that it had miscalculated, and it revised its estimate of casualties sharply downward. Because they did not know where Iraq was hiding its germ weapons, the analysts had put together a worst-case forecast in which it was assumed that each site housed Iraq's entire arsenal. There was a second crucial mistake. The fusion group had initially estimated that 1% to 10% of the spores would survive an explosion and float into the air. Consultation with several veterans of the American germ program, including Bill Patrick, suggested that the actual number would be much, much lower, less than 0.1%. The new analysis still offered sobering predictions. It said the Allied bombing was likely to cause hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Iraqi civilians to suffer painful, lingering deaths from inhaled anthrax. Senior officials weighed the risks, and assuming that was to be the cost of taking the biological option out of Saddam's hands forever, accepted them. The general whom Powell had assigned to work the vaccine issue, John Jumper, sent a message to Schwarzkopf in early December suggesting a way to stretch the limited vaccine supplies. A combination of doxycycline and vaccine had kept alive all the monkeys in the Fort Detrick study. The commanders could administer antibiotics to all 500,000 troops and keep the vaccine in reserve to treat anyone attacked with anthrax. Jumper's cable puzzled Schwarzkopf's medical officers. Anthrax multiplies rapidly in the body, and the researchers had begun treating the monkeys within a day of exposure. Because the detector problem remained unsolved, the first signs of exposure could appear days later, when soldiers began complaining of flu. Sending troops on antibiotics into battle was risky, Schwarzkopf's medical advisors felt. The drug recommended in the cable, ciprofloxacin, was a powerful antibiotic that sometimes caused serious diarrhea and other side effects. It also killed normal bacteria in the gut, leaving only resistant germs. A soldier shot in the stomach would stand a greater chance of contracting an untreatable infection. The doctors met with Schwarzkopf on December 6th to review Jumper's cable. Colonel James David Bales, Jr., an infectious disease specialist assigned to CENTCOM just a few days after the invasion of Kuwait, leaned over the commander and watched his eyes flicker across the page. As Schwarzkopf read the passage about the need to administer the vaccine and Cipro within 24 hours, Bales said, "And how are you going to know that?" The more experienced officers in the room braced for an explosion. Schwarzkopf hated interruptions, but he agreed with Bales. The antibiotic approach was too risky without reliable detectors. The next day, Schwarzkopf sent a private, eyes-only message to Powell rejecting the widespread use of antibiotics. He preferred to vaccinate, even if there was not enough for everyone. A decision to immunize, he reiterated, had serious implications for the coalition and could be made only in Washington. The impasse frustrated Colonel George E. Lewis, a microbiologist who was working for Jumper and helped prepare the cable on antibiotics. Military officers made life and death decisions every day. They calculated how many men would be sent to attack a particular target or how much air cover was required for dangerous operations. Why was it so hard to decide whom to protect against biological attack? The January 15th deadline set by the United Nations for Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait was just 5 weeks away, and Lewis knew the Allies had already waited too long. To obtain even partial immunity, inoculation should have begun in mid-November. Each day's delay raised the danger. The Pentagon calculated that soldiers who received their first shots on December 10th would not be minimally protected against anthrax until January 21st, and against botulism until April 1st. Project Badger's efforts to make more vaccine had fallen well short. The Michigan lab had produced enough anthrax vaccine to protect about 150,000 of the 500,000 American troops in the region. There was none to share with allies or American civilians in Saudi Arabia. Defenses against botulism were even more limited. Despite considerable effort, not a single additional dose had been produced. There was still only enough for 10,000 soldiers. On December 9th, the British added to the pressure. General Peter de la Billière met with Schwarzkopf in Riyadh and told him that he intended to begin immunizing his troops unless the United States had strenuous objections. British officials, unlike the Americans, believed Iraq had turned anthrax and plague into weapons, and they intended to protect their troops against both. The British bought an American vaccine against plague that was still experimental and was known to cause temporary but debilitating flu-like side effects. The Saudis learned of the British plans and asked Schwarzkopf whether he would provide some anthrax vaccine to protect their troops. The American commander said he did not have enough for his own soldiers. A senior Saudi general asked whether Washington could at least set aside some shots for the royal family. It was an awkward request. Saudi Arabia's willingness to allow American forces on its soil had made Operation Desert Storm possible, but Schwarzkopf had none to share. On December 10th, Schwarzkopf called Powell on a secure phone to rehash the decision to bomb the biological bunkers and production plants. He told the chairman that it would be an unforgivable sin not to attack the germ targets. It was the only way to guarantee that the weapons would not be used.